everyone. Thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's July 2019, and you're listening to episode 132 of Postmodern Realities, which is a review of the Netflix sci-fi film, I Am Mother. On this episode, I'm joined by Melissa Kane Travis. Melissa has a PhD from Faulkner University in Humanities with a concentration in philosophy, and she is an assistant professor at Houston Baptist University, where she teaches graduate courses in science and faith and philosophy of religion. She is also the author of Science and the Mind of the Maker, What the Conversation Between Faith and Science Reveals About God. Melissa has written an online exclusive film review, and it's available free at our website, equip.org. And it's called The Artistic Pro-Life Theme in Netflix's I Am Mother. Melissa, it's good to have you on.
Thanks, Melanie. It's good to chat with you.
Well, summertime is a good time for people to get caught up on various different films. And this is one in the sci-fi genre. And there's a lot of those out there now. And a lot of them are very thought-provoking. So this one is exclusively on Netflix and stars Oscar winner Hilary Swank, as well as Rose Byrne as the voice of this robot. And so we just want to talk a little bit about some of the themes, which were really a bit surprising, I think, in this film. I hadn't heard of it until you mentioned that you were watching it. So in the beginning of your article, you mentioned the value of philosophical themes in general in the genre of science fiction. So can you explain a little bit more about that for our listeners?
Sure. When most people think about science fiction, the first thing they think of is the science and technology element. So the spacecraft, the robots, the lightsabers, and the aliens, for example. Or in the recent spate of films about artificial intelligence, you think about the human likeness of some of the androids. But if you stop and think about it, one of the reasons we're able to connect with some science fiction on a deeper level is because of the themes that are directly related to our humanity. In other words, we're able to identify with the struggles and the desires of the human characters. And I personally think that the most compelling science fiction, and I've heard many others agree with me on this, are the stories that get us thinking about higher level philosophical questions. Questions like, what makes us human? Or questions about the ethical issues surrounding hypothetical technologies, or maybe just hypothetical applications of technologies that we already have. So artificial intelligence seems to be the hot plot element right now. And we ask questions like, could man-made machines ever have genuine consciousness? Could they ever experience the world around them the way us biological humans can? Now, I believe that's metaphysically impossible, but hypothetically, would such things make them true people? And would they have the same value that biological humans do? And those are the kinds of questions that we see explored in films like Blade Runner, for example. And I thought Blade Runner 2049, the newer Blade Runner film, was actually quite well done in this respect. And then another good example of this theme is seen in the film, I think it's a few years old now, Ex Machina, which explored these questions about the possibility of hard artificial intelligence. But then it also went this big philosophical step further by implying that biological humans are essentially no different from an artificially intelligent android because we're, according to the film, nothing more than the matter we're made of. And then we function strictly according to our operating system, which would be our genetic programming and the environmental pressures that we experience from the external world. And at the end of the day, there's no genuine free will for a human being according to these kinds of plot lines. And that's a very materialist message. So I think it's this kind of sci-fi that raises these philosophical issues that really leaves us pondering for long after the film or the TV show has ended. art is a powerful shaper of ideas. And I think science fiction plays an enormous role in forming cultural attitudes, not just towards technology and futuristic technologies that may be on the horizon, but also about the human ethics that become involved with that kind of technology.
Well, I want to let our listeners know, speaking of some of those films that Melissa mentioned, that we have a review online at our website, equip.org, that you can read for free. And it's a review of Blade Runner 2049. And in addition, we also have another article that explores some of those issues in Ex Machina, and it's called Digital Souls, What Christians Should Believe About Artificial Intelligence. And that's also free online at our website, equip.org. Before we kind of dig into some of the philosophical issues that this particular film raises, can you give our listeners just kind of like kind of set the scene for the plot elements of the film I Am Mother?
Sure. So the idea behind the film, the opening premise, is that the human race has been wiped out. We have no idea what has occurred to cause this, but we see in the opening of the film the inside of sort of a bunker facility, and the superimposed text on the screen lets us know that it's some sort of human preservation facility that's meant to house the elements necessary to somehow replenish the human race. And this facility is being run by a rather human-like robot. It doesn't have a human face, human appearance, but it's an upright walking anthropoid type robot who's in charge. And as the first action scene begins, you see this robot retrieving a human embryo from a storage container and inserting it into an artificial womb. So the film has set up for you what's going on with the human race and how this technology is supposed to help the human race recover from whatever apocalyptic event has occurred.
So when you first decided to watch this film, I Am Mother, did you have any kind of expectation about philosophical issues it might explore? Because when you're describing that opening scene, that seems a little bit startling. In fact, when I watched it, I don't know that I expected that. I just thought it'd be your typical kind of, you know, apocalyptic wasteland thing. And then all of a sudden I'm in this like facility and you see this idea happening where you see these embryos. So did you have any expectations about the content, like the just kind of the themes of the film?
Actually, not at all. My husband and I had watched a trailer for it and it looked rather interesting. And honestly, I didn't expect it to be a stellar film based upon Netflix's track record. I don't think this is a Netflix original, but I think it's what they call a Netflix exclusive. So a film that they've picked up and they have exclusive rights to, but not a film that Netflix actually made. But either way, in my opinion, they don't have a stellar track record with some of these kinds of films. So it was just one of those things, for lack of something better to watch, the trailer looked kind of interesting. I really thought it would be one more mediocre take on the whole artificial intelligence takes over the world plotline that seems to be done to death lately. But my husband and I were sci-fi fanatics, so if there's even a possibility that it's going to be decent, we're usually willing to give it a try. But we were only a few minutes into this film when I really began to suspect that there was a possibility of some interesting philosophical theme. And as the film went on, I became more and more convinced that the theme I was noticing involved the sanctity of life, including the sanctity of life of the unborn.
So you kind of described the opening of the film, the bunker, this robot pulling out these human embryos, you know, kind of as the first indication that there might be a pro-life not necessarily message, but just some considerations about that, that there's a theme of that. So why did this imagery in specific give you that impression? Because it was human embryos, just that part of it?
Well, it was more than that, because in current in vitro technology, human embryos are placed into cryogenic storage. In other words, they're frozen within a week after the fertilization takes place. So in real life, if we were to go and visit an embryo storage facility, we'd discover all these special freezers full of tiny little tubes that appear to just contain a little bit of frozen fluid. But the filmmakers of I Am Mother chose to instead portray a more advanced medical technology that we don't possess, but hence science fiction genre, that suspends the in vitro development somewhere around the end of the first trimester of gestation, or 12 weeks along. And so the imagery in the film, as a result, is quite breathtaking. We see these intricately formed embryos that are immediately recognizable as human beings. The embryos are encased in these perfectly clear crystalline spheres, and we can see all the features of their little bodies, their arms and their legs and their hands and their feet. We see blood vessels. We see the silhouette of the brain. We can see their developing faces, the little dark spots where their eyes are developing. And then the storage columns are labeled with serial numbers, but they're also labeled male and female. And so the visual effect of these 12-week embryos, I'm calling them 12-week based on some of the research I did after the fact, after watching the film. So the overall effect is this humanizing of the unborn. The filmmakers could have just as easily have shown a much earlier stage of development, and that would not have had this kind of visceral impact on the viewer. When you look at a 12-week human embryo as they're portrayed in the film, it's far more difficult to just pretend that the embryo is not really a human being. So I really suspect that this artistic decision had a higher purpose.
Well, in the film, it's rather dialogue driven. In fact, there's only three main characters in the film and nobody has a specific name. It's just like, you know, daughter, mother, and then woman. So talk about some of the dialogue between the characters that you found were relevant to the whole issue of the sanctity of life.
Oh, there were several dialogue scenes that I thought used some rather pointed language about the value of the unborn. But I think my favorite scene comes early on in the film. So the viewer has been able to see a time-lapse sequence of a little girl, first her development in an artificial womb, then her birth, her toddler years, and some of her early childhood. And all along the way, she's being raised by this artificially intelligent droid. And then there comes this scene where daughter, which as you said, is the only name we ever know her by, asks the droid, "Why aren't there any more children, mother?" And the droid, who in the film is thereafter referred to simply as mother, takes daughter to the embryo storage room and she shows her these high-tech computerized storage units. And the daughter says, "My brothers and sisters are in those." And mother asks her, "Would you like to meet them?" And so then mother pulls one of the columns containing the embryos out of one of the storage units. And we get another close-up visual of these beautiful, well-developed human embryos. And mother says to daughter, "They're small now, but one day they'll be as big as you." And I thought this dialogue exchange was remarkable. While it necessarily has a childlike simplicity to it because of the child character in the dialogue, the language very specifically humanizes the unborn, first of all, by highlighting the embryo's familial relation to daughter, calling them her brothers and sisters. the implication is they're people and they're precious. And there's at least a couple of times in the film where the embryos are referred to collectively as the unborns. And it's done in a manner that seems to suggest they're being referred to as a people group in their own right. So I found this just astonishing.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Melissa Kane Travis, and she has written an online exclusive film review of the Netflix film I Am Mother, and it's available free online at our website at quip.org. It's really vital that you help us to provide all this great equipping free online content in the form of this Postmodern Realities podcast and all of our online exclusive feature articles, book reviews, and film reviews like this one by partnering with us with a print subscription. So we'd like to invite you to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. A subscription is $33.50 and you can subscribe at our website, equip.org. But you might already be a subscriber. So here's another way that you can support this podcast, our journal, and all of the resources at the Christian Research Institute website and our outreaches like the Bible Answer Man broadcast and our other podcast, Hank Unplugged. And that is you can now tip us at our website. When you read our articles or listen to our podcast, you're going to find a link at our website at the landing page for this episode for this film review, I Am Mother. And I'd encourage you to go to the website. If you click magazine and at the drop-down menu, click PMR podcast, you're going to find the landing page of this episode. And if you enjoy our content, there's a link where you can give us a tip of a small amount, like $3 or $5, which is basically the equivalent cost of your favorite coffee drink. Or just think about all the times that you access this content, whether it's this podcast, if you enjoy it, and any of our articles. You know, every month, a lot of us just, you know, are willing to pay, you know, $10 to subscribe to Netflix where you can watch this film. And please think of giving us a tip for that. And that's a monthly subscription, whereas maybe a tip of $3 or $5 or $10 is just a way that you can say thank you to us for this material that we would like to continue to bring you completely free. And as I've said on past podcasts, a lot of websites are now under paywalls, or they didn't used to be under paywalls and they're putting their content under paywalls. And so we don't do that at all. All of these podcasts and as well as all of our articles are completely free. So if you enjoy this content, please consider giving us a tip if you already subscribe, or maybe a subscription isn't in your budget this month. Please think of giving us a small tip just as a way of supporting this content to keep bringing it to you completely free. And thank you. In your review, you mentioned something called the substance view of human persons. Can you elaborate on that idea?
The substance view of human persons is this idea that a human being remains the same kind of thing throughout his or her entire existence, that human personhood is an all or nothing kind of thing. It's not something that just comes in degrees over time or something that can be diminished by any external circumstances. So, for example, I was just as much of a human person when I was 3 days old as I am today. I'm now larger and far more developed, and I'm a lot less dependent upon others for my survival and well-being, but I'm not more of a human person than I was when I was only 3 days old. I've always had full human personhood, and the same is true of me a week before I was even born. So my location and my degree of dependence upon my mother was different. But those external conditions don't affect your status as a human person. And so if we were to start from there the week before I was born and go back to 2 weeks before I was born, 2 months before, the only difference is size and level of development. Just like I'm more developed now and I'm larger now than I was at only 3 days old, the same situation would be going on months before birth compared to just a week before birth. But that doesn't reduce the status of human personhood. And then if we go in the other direction, if one day as I reach old age, I begin losing some of my higher faculties, and maybe one day I'll become more dependent on others for my survival and well-being, that won't mean I've lost part of my human personhood. I'll still be just as much of a human person as I am today. So humanity, and by the word humanity, I mean human personhood, it's, again, it's an all or nothing kind of thing. Physical characteristics and location changes over time can change, but our essence as human persons is entirely independent of those kinds of things. And we could give lots of examples to demonstrate why this is true.
So is this substance view of human persons, is that something that's regularly used in pro-life apologetics?
Yes, actually it is. Some of our listeners may be familiar with the really outstanding work being done by Life Training Institute, or LTI for short. And incidentally, one of their main speakers, Megan Allman, is another CRJ contributor. LTI uses this acronym called SLED, S-L-E-D, to communicate this substance view of human persons in the context of pro-life apologetics. So the idea is that there are basically four different characteristics that distinguish the unborn human being from one that is already born. S stands for size, the unborn is smaller. L stands for level of development, the unborn is less developed. E stands for environment. The unborn is in the womb. The born is outside of the womb. And then finally, D stands for degree of dependence. So the unborn has a higher degree of dependence upon the mother than the born person does. So in short, if we take each one of these four distinctions and we're to play them out to their logical conclusions, we come to see why none of these differences between the unborn and the born can work to disqualify the unborn from human personhood. So I've already mentioned level of development and degree of dependence, but in the film, we encounter a reference to the size difference. Mother says to daughter, they're small now, but one day they'll be as big as you. And so this statement in the context of that particular dialogue, I think, does a really great job of equating the essence of daughter and the essence of the unborn. They're both the same kind of thing, even though the embryo is far smaller. So through this statement, the embryos are implicitly categorized as human persons. And just a few moments before that in the dialogue, they're explicitly referred to as the brothers and sisters of daughter. They're already human persons despite their size, their level of development, and their degree of dependence on the gestational technology. But obviously, in the film scenario, the environment and the degree of dependence are not the same as in a real life human pregnancy, because the film uses artificial wombs. But I think this just further highlights the point that environment and degree of dependence are essentially irrelevant to the question of the kind of entities the embryos are. So as we emphasize in pro-life apologetics, the central issue is the question, what is the unborn? And I think this film does a marvelous job of answering that question.
So besides the very specific embryo imagery that we get where we can see those little 12-week-old embryos, are there any other artistic decisions that the filmmakers made that seem to you to intentionally humanize these unborn embryos that we see?
I think so. Well, obviously, the dialogue, as I've just talked about, but also daughter's attitude throughout the film about the intrinsic value of the embryos, and then later her attitude about the value of the gestating baby. So she repeatedly refers to that baby as her brother, and she refuses to leave him behind or let him be subject to any danger. Not because he's a future person, but because he is a person, and thus she views him as inherently valuable. And also, there are two different scenes in the film where the distinct sound of the heartbeat of the unborn can be heard very clearly. So one instance is the first action scene in the film where we see for the very first time the procedure of inserting the embryo into the artificial womb. Almost immediately, we hear the heartbeat beginning. And then later, during the gestation of the brother, there's a scene where daughter places her hand on the artificial womb and she just stands there listening to the baby's heartbeat. And to me, the unspoken implication is clear that the unborn are human beings, and as such, they're highly valuable and they're worthy of our love and protection.
You mentioned in your review that even if the writers of the screenplay did not specifically intend to promote like a pro-life message, that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. So why would you say that? Because I don't think that the filmmakers are Christians or anything like that. So why wouldn't it be a bad thing that they weren't intentionally pro-life?
Well, I guess what I mean in my article is more along the lines of if their message is entirely unintentional, is that necessarily a bad thing? Whether or not the filmmakers themselves are Christians or maybe do have pro-life views, if they were questioned on that specifically, I think is really a separate question. But just zeroing in on the question of whether or not the pro-life message was intended, and if it was not, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. If the message is completely unintentional, I think that says something particularly interesting. So good art communicates themes that emerge from our deepest human intuitions about reality. So in other words, good art involves quintessentially humane truths. At a gut level, we sense the value of the unborn. We understand at that level that they're members of the human family. So if these filmmakers did not intend to communicate such a strong pro-life message, the fact that the message came through anyway, through the way they told the story, the way they treated the human embryos visually and in the dialogue and in daughter's attitude towards the embryos, I think that's very, very telling about how at a fundamental level, we all have this sense that the unborn are not disposable.
So if the pro-life message is unintentional, do you think that the filmmakers maybe had a related idea in mind?
Well, I think it's possible that the intended message was the importance of the preservation of the human race, because broadly speaking, all human beings are valuable, and maybe they wanted to highlight the fortitude of the heroine who seeks to ensure that the human race comes back to flourish and carry on. When daughter looks through the sketches of people that she finds in the injured woman's bag, she's looking at these sketches of people who she is told live down in what they refer to as the mines with other human survivors. And as she's looking at these sketches, you can tell that her heart is very burdened. She looks at these human faces and clearly understands the objective value of these people and understands it in a way that, as the film goes on, we see is very much in contrast with how she understands the value of artificial intelligence. So I think it's very possible that those may have been the intended messages of the film, but in portraying or communicating those messages very well, as I think the film does, maybe a byproduct of that was this pro-life message in terms of the value of the unborn.
Did you think there were any aspects of the film that gave you a sense that the filmmakers were in particular friendly to Christian ideas at all?
I really think so, yes. This was another very provocative element of the film, I thought. There are several scenes with Christian imagery, and it's done without any sort of negative undertone. So, for example, in one scene, the injured woman who shows up at the bunker, her life is hanging in the balance because of her injury. And she has this handmade rosary in her hand, and the camera zooms in on it, and you very clearly see what the object is. And she's rubbing it, and she's saying prayers, and you can hear her prayers. And then in a separate scene, daughter is going through the things from the woman's bag. And there's this very brief glimpse of what truly appears to be a leaf out of a Bible, the way the text is formatted on the piece of paper. And I zoomed in as much as I could, and I can't say for sure, but just the visual of the arrangement of the text on the sheet made it very much look as if it's meant to be understood as a page out of a Bible. And then there's a scene where daughter's taking this exam and you're hearing the questions, and it's clearly meant to gauge her psychological state. And after she finishes answering all the questions, there's this screen in front of her that starts showing a rapid sequence of different images. And one of these images is Christ on the cross. Another of the images is the Virgin Mary with her palms out and her arms outstretched. Later on, we get a look inside the shelter that is used by the injured woman in the film. And the camera zooms in on this shrine that's set up in one corner with candles. And the imagery around it is all very distinctly Christian. So it's fascinating to me that all of these Christian visuals were included in the film, but it was done so without any further comment whatsoever. It's like you get these zoom-ins by the camera as if the filmmakers want to be very sure you've noticed the Christian imagery, but then it doesn't really play into the story, and there's zero dialogue about it. So it left me pondering what exactly the filmmakers wanted to accomplish with this. I thought, well, maybe this is just a nod to the idea that there's a natural human need for the transcendent, for us to have hope for the future. That would, I guess, make sense in an apocalyptic style film. I'd like to think that the intended point is a lot more specific than that. The idea that even in a terrible post-apocalyptic situation, the gospel would endure, even if it was just through one surviving individual. That's what I hope it was, but you never know.
Well, what's interesting, because there's all kinds of, we don't want to spoil the movie, but there's all kinds of just different things that happen so rapidly. You're trying to figure out what's going on at the end. I had to read a few articles to figure out, okay, this happened and this happened. But before, you know, doing that, and I came to the end, I did have a question about how did religion survive? Because, you know, there's been this huge apocalypse, and when she was, you know, counting her rosary beads or doing whatever she was doing with them in her hand, I was asking myself that question. Wait, those look very much like rosary beads. How is religion in this whole world, this post-apocalyptic world, even still exist, you know, with the belief of somebody? So it does make you ponder that for sure. And it is very noticeable. It was noticeable to me. And you're right, they had no explanation for it at all. It's just showing in this time of crisis, she's injured and she feels helpless. This is what she's turning to. She's praying. So I thought that was very fascinating. Did you think there are other important philosophical themes in the film besides this pro-life message?
You know, I think there's actually a great deal more we could try to unpack. But the more obvious is related to what we've already been discussing. Before the film hits its major crisis, round about the middle of the film, there's this classroom scene in which mother obviously is acting as the instructor, and she's having this Socratic discussion with daughter on the topic of ethics and moral philosophy. So several famous philosophers are mentioned in quick succession, and among those are a couple of utilitarian philosophers. And there's this tension that gets set up between the theory that the good is defined as doing what will benefit the greatest number of people. So that's the utilitarian view. And it's set up in tension with the idea that every single human being is intrinsically valuable. So Mother creates this interesting thought experiment that keeps you thinking about this specific moral dilemma a long time after the film is over. It's akin to the famous trolley problem for any of our listeners who might be familiar with that. And then as the second half of the film plays out, the crisis comes and it's moving towards resolution. What we see is that deep down, daughter, who has grown up with no other human contact, she still understands objective human value in a way that mother does not and cannot, and that this utilitarian ethics idea can ultimately have undeniably evil consequences. So it's in this way that we see the inevitable limitations of hypothetical artificial intelligence and why the pursuit of that kind of technology is probably not in our best interest. And I should probably leave it at that so we don't give away too much more of the plot.
Yeah, I would say that the takeaway that I had was, even though this girl daughter was raised without any other humans and only this droid, she is the one who values human life the most, more than mother. Right. So I did find that very interesting. Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Melissa. So, Melissa, it's summer. So, if you're going to do some grilling, do you prefer burgers or hot dogs?
Oh, burgers.
Vacation away, or do you like to take a staycation?
That's hard. Vacation away.
And if you are on vacation, are you the kind of person who likes to lounge at the beach or by the pool, or do you like to fill your days with sightseeing and going to museums and activities?
Oh, sightseeing and activities for sure.
And if money was no object, where would you go on your ideal vacation?
Italy.
That sounds like a great European vacation. Well, thanks for being a guest, Melissa, on the Postmodern Realities Podcast.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Dr. Melissa Kane Travis, and we've been having a discussion about the Netflix film I Am Mother. You can read her review of this film at our website, equip.org, and it's completely free to read. And I would also like to invite you to partner with us in two ways. First of all, you can become a print subscriber to the Christian Research Journal. In doing so, it helps keep all of this content free. A subscription is $33.50, and go to equip.org to subscribe. In addition, at equip.org, both at Melissa's article as well as on the landing page to this episode of our podcast, you can click the link where you can give us a tip to say thank you for this free material. A tip is a way that you can support us if maybe perhaps a subscription isn't in your budget right now, or you're already a print subscriber. You can tip us at $3, $5, $10 or more. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast.